From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
How has the coronavirus affected your current relationship at home? Perhaps two of you are working from home and are spending more time under one roof together than ever before. We are now forced to connect with loved ones in ways that we certainly aren't used to. Michelle Clodfelder is a licensed professional counselor with Mental Health for Black Hills Psychology. She joined us with a therapeutic look at love inside a pandemic.
Michelle, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Lori.
And I want to let listeners know that we want to hear your questions, and we're going to have another conversation about this next week that will directly address some of those questions. So you can send them now or in the days ahead to inthemoment@sdpb.org or text 956-SDPB with some of those relationship questions. And Michelle, I'm wondering what you're seeing in your practice. Are there more people who are reaching out, or the people you already work with having new problems because everything in our lives changed a few weeks ago?
Well, I think that the latter question, people in the practice having increased anxiety, right? We already come into this world with anxiety, and then it builds up on that. Dealing with partners being around us all the time, yay. kind of the idea of how do we do this? How do we do this forced togetherness when it wasn't planned? So, and I looked on the internet, of course, because don't we all go to Google, about love and coronavirus. And the first thing that pops up was all of the creativeness that people are using in order to continue, especially if it's a new relationship. And kind of how we're redefining love now and redefining and reprioritizing what's important in our lives in general, right?
Right. So much to talk about there. And that was one of the things that I was thinking about the other day. What does it mean to prioritize someone in your life? Because you're also living a life. And how do you know? And of course it came up because I had forgotten someone in a really significant way. And I thought, how could that even happen? And it got me to thinking, what does it look like to prioritize someone? That must be different for everyone, right? Is that something you talk about and ask each other? Or how do you approach just that general question of what does it mean to make somebody, you know, your significant other, your life partner?
I think in this specific situation that we're in currently, it's a lot about changing expectations to acceptance. How do I change what I expect someone to do for me or to do in this situation to looking at how do I accept what they're doing and how do I accept what they're doing in this situation? We tend to think either in the past or the far future, instead of being in the moment and saying, you know, I think we're a little stressed out here. Let's take the next 3 minutes and just kind of be okay with being okay here. The other thing that a lot of us don't do, you know, the saying, I didn't plan to fail, I failed to plan. Setting up the night before and saying, okay, my schedule tomorrow looks like this. The first hour, break it into 15-minute increments so that you can become successful at doing something. We beat ourselves up about motivation, lack of motivation. How about if we just talk about building momentum? I want to build momentum in my life. Motivation, it's going to turn into negative self-talk in this situation, even when it comes into respect of how am I treating my partner? How am I treating myself? What do I expect of myself and what can I accept of myself? So kind of that idea of this is what my day tomorrow looks like And you want to stop and have lunch together, the same as you would if you were not in the same house.
Right.
I don't know.
Is it okay to say to somebody, like, I just, you know, I need some time. I need some space. Does every couple need a little bit of space? And how do you get that when you don't have the natural routine ways of getting that space, whether it's, you know, you go to coffee with your friends or you go see your sister or you go to work. How do you ask for what you need as far as time away without sort of hurting somebody else's, and how do you accept that in return as not being hurtful?
Well, one thing is to prepare them for it and say, you know, tomorrow I'd like to go out and be with friends. The second part is, and probably the most important part, making it about yourself. This is what I need. It's not about getting away from you. I really need to just laugh with my friends about the silly, you know, crazy things that we do. In our home, I'm an equine assisted psychotherapist. And I will say, I think I need to go out and be with the horses or I need to be with the walk, getting that different perspective, just like going on a vacation, you come back, you have a different perspective of what's going on in the house. And it generally has calmed you down. The earlier you can identify that your anxiety is building or your frustration, your anger, just the feeling of being overwhelmed, the better. And generally all of those feelings present themselves physically in our body if we're in tune to it. Either our stomach, our right under our chest or our throat will kind of get worked up, and you may not know why. It isn't about figuring out why. It's about saying, I'm experiencing this now, and so can I deal with this now? And then the why, as we start to work towards the future, the why or the past kind of works itself out, and it becomes less important because you're being successful here and now. Mm-hmm. And that way also, it isn't about, well, you did this, I need to get out of here. No, I just need to get out. I just need to see something different, go for a drive, you know, out here we have Spearfish Canyon, so I just need to go for a drive in the canyon, stop and listen to the water, something like that, something different.
You mentioned horses and Spearfish Canyon, and I'm wondering what some of those things and how do you identify them for yourselves? And maybe you could say a little bit more about, like, what does time with the horses do for you or do for people that people could either learn from or could find a way to apply to, you know, an urban setting or a rural setting where you don't have access to that right now. What does it do for people that is so healing? Why does it work?
Well, first off, to address the question of the horses, any animal, especially in dealing with anxiety, I work, my theoretical perspective is called dialectic behavior therapy. And what it wants to do is anything that we, our five senses, anything that can address our five senses is going to take our mind away from the anxiety. And our head can't do both. If I'm drinking a hot cup of tea, my mind will immediately say, ooh, that's really hot. I should like make sure my survival kicks in. I don't want to burn my mouth. So for that millisecond, if we start building and using and I know this tastes good and it's really good, and all of a sudden, without even recognizing it, your anxiety is going down. So it's about building on that. Pets and animals, focusing on loving them and making, like, petting them and really feeling like it's about setting that small amount of time, 2 to 3 minutes. I'm going to sit down and just really pet my dog and really just see where they relax. Our somatic nervous system, when we're comforting an animal or relaxing an animal, our body will naturally move into that space and do that. The horses are different. The best way I can describe it is they will mirror, if you allow them to be horses, because they're herd and prey animals, they will mirror what's going on inside you. And it's the most bizarre thing. I get kind of cocky because I think, oh, I know my horses. Huh. I can tell you what they're going to do. And every time a client comes out and starts their interaction, the horses are different. And I'm like, wow, I did not know that they would do that. Or we have a donkey as well, and she's very incredibly intuitive. So, and their sixth sense keeps them alive. We miss out on that because, you know, we try to minimize our sixth sense, even with our partners, right? You can tell, most people can tell when there's something wrong with their partners. Their partners don't have to say anything. They don't have to walk around with a scowl on their face. It's that internal clock or that internal sense that says, what is wrong with you? There's something going on here. We see that with people with depression. They don't recognize it, but we look at them and go, are you okay? Are you doing okay? And they'll be, oh, I'm fine. Leave me alone. I'm just fine. Mm-hmm. I'm just a little sad. I'm fine. It'll be okay. So, yeah. And when you see a 1,500-pound animal acting, mirroring what's going on inside you, it sticks with you. It imprints itself on your brain much more so than anything else, right?
From this perspective of paying attention to your five senses and what's going on in your body, talk to someone who is stuck in an apartment and that's, you know, really all they have. Now, maybe obviously we can all go out. Most of us can go outside and breathe the spring air. But are there ways to engage the senses that are small sorts of things that would help with the anxiety and with with depression? If you're living in a much smaller space than you were living in before, metaphorically and physically.
Well, and literally now, we're all living in a much smaller space right now. And so really, one thing I would suggest and seems to have been very helpful with a lot of clients is planning your day tomorrow, the night before. And I don't mean on a strict, like, well, I have to do this and I have to do this and I have to do this. It's really about the night before saying, well, I'm going to take a 15-minute walk at noon. What happens in that process is that our brain looks forward to what we're doing at noon. And so instead of sitting in the misery and the muck of, oh, I'm stuck in the house, your brain is saying, hey, at noon you get to go for a walk. And then we're going to come back and have lunch. And this is what you're having for lunch. So that pre-planning, you're setting yourself up for success. And it's not a huge change. We want to make shifts. I call it a shuffle instead of a change in behavior, a shuffle in behavior, because it's about changing our perception. It's about changing those expectations of self and others to accepting self and others. And not in a way where it's, oh, you know, do whatever you want. It's in a way of actually kind of forming your own boundaries, like, oh, I'm glad that worked for you, and this is what's going to work for me.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that because regarding communication, some people might be more anxious about the current situation, financial insecurity, job insecurity, just going to get groceries, where you might be married to someone or in a relationship with someone who is less concerned about things and maybe thinks you're overreacting to even, you know, a daily stressor or the pandemic in general. What are some of the ways we can communicate and listen to one another that helps us validate those feelings without being, you know, sort of captured by somebody else's way of seeing the world?
Well, one way that I try to approach everything is, in general, we are successful in our lives in different areas, and we just haven't learned how to transfer that success into areas where we aren't successful. So with couples communicating, it's about planning, like saying, hey, Thursday night, I'd like to talk about our finances for the next 2 weeks. Could you bring three like out-of-the-box ideas, and I'll bring three out-of-the-box ideas, and we can kind of negotiate from there about what we'd like to do. That's how you would do it in a business. You would say to all your department heads, you would say, hey, guys, next Thursday's meeting, we need to cut 20%. Everybody get together, decide what and where and how you can cut, and let's kind of negotiate what we can do to be successful. That's true leadership, not micromanaging, right? Mm-hmm. And in this situation, we need to truly delegate. We need to say, this is what needs to be done. This is when it needs to be done. I trust you to do that and move on with it. And so it's kind of about saying, and the other part too is most often fights about money or time or you're not paying enough attention to me really are lack of preparedness, because we react back to them. What do you mean? We don't have enough money. I thought this happened. I thought that happened. Whereas in if you say, let's talk about this, I'm going to bring three ideas. We could win the lottery. That's one of my out-of-the-box ideas. There's laughter. There's negotiation. There's it's working together. It's forming that bond. One of the highest indicators of a strong relationship is how many times you laugh during the day. And laughter forms that kind of I got your back perspective in our brain. Like, hey, we made it through this hard time laughing through it. We can make it through this hard time laughing through it, even though it might not be easy.
Yeah.
And it might not be fun. We can still laugh about it. There's still things we can find. We get to choose if we want to respond or react. Respond is thinking. Reaction is feeling.
Now, images of the past allows us an opportunity to go back in time and learn about what shaped South Dakota. This Monday, we shine the light on a company that began operating in the early 1900s and had locations in several South Dakota cities like Aberdeen, Rapid City, and Sioux Falls. Bill Hoskins is the director of Siouxland Heritage Museums in Sioux Falls, and he joined us to tell about the Manchester Biscuit Company.
Bill, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, Lori. How are you? Happy to be here and talk a little bit about the Manchester Biscuit Company.
I'm happy to hear your voice. You sound healthy. Is everyone on the staff staying well and facing those challenges of this time? How's that been for the Siouxland Heritage Museums?
Well, we're doing great. We're really laying the ground for the day when we can reopen. We've got a great new exhibit on first floor that are scenes of Sioux Falls in the past, a photo exhibit. There's some great images there. So I can't wait for the time when we can reopen and the public can come in again.
Yeah, that's a nice large building. It seems like a good place that you could spend some time and not get too close to other people if things are planned out well. So I have fingers crossed for that place being able to reopen soon. I want to talk about Manchester Biscuit Company, but Bill, it seems like now, once we have this pandemic, everybody's looking to the past as well and pulling up these archival photos of, you know, previous pandemics and newspaper headlines. And yet here we are living through our own history. And it just reminds me so much of my time with the museum and just how that was so much of what the staff there talks about on a daily basis of things that are happening now and how we see the seeds for them in our history. And we see how things have changed and how they haven't changed. So historians are kind of experiencing this pandemic the same way as the rest of us in trying to keep people safe and keep themselves healthy, but also with this broader eye to documenting it and understanding it. Has that been your experience, that it's been kind of fascinating to look at pandemics in previous centuries as well as we live through our own?
Well, it's always interesting. I think that as historians, or we don't really think of history, but we make decisions every day based upon our history, our experiences in life, what we did or didn't do, and how we think they turned out for us. So really every decision just about that we make is based upon history. So it's been very interesting looking at how decisions are made in view of history. This pandemic, we have all these computer-generated models. where are the models getting their information? It's based on the history of the past epidemics, how they have happened. And so it's been really interesting to see how it all plays out.
Yeah, well said. All right. Images of the past, the Manchester Biscuit Company. I had not heard of this, but I, in retrospect, know where the building is because it's a pretty iconic spot in Sioux Falls. Tell me about this this biscuit company.
Well, you probably, the public probably knows it as Raven Industries on 6th Street, right at the Big Sioux River. And it's a company that goes back in Sioux Falls to about 1902. It was founded by a guy named Lawrence Manchester, who was born in Iowa and grew up in Iowa. But he came at first to Sioux Falls about 1888, where he started working for a baker in town. And in those days, there were a lot of bakeries. Baked goods are something that I certainly enjoy, but they were here in the past. He moved over to Laverne in the 1890s and was there for about 10 years when Andrew Keene, who was a wholesale grocer, and the Jewett brothers, who had a wholesale fruit distributing, talked him to come to Sioux Falls and open a baking company in Sioux Falls that would really have more of a mass appeal than a craft shop as we think of today. And it was a great business. They started in a little two-story stone building, and it continued to grow. Almost every year they added on more staff. They built a new building. Pretty soon they outgrew that, added on. And I think the last addition to that building was actually in the 1940s, 1946, the final addition that we're familiar with today, the kind of yellow building, it was built. Lawrence Manchester died in 1930. His business continued on to grow and prosper until about 1960, when it finally closed up.
How come I haven't heard his name, in the sense that, you know, so many of these other people who had successful businesses at this time, you know, there's streets named after them and there's parks named after them, and I haven't heard much about Manchester.
Well, that's a good question. I really don't know the answer. He was fairly involved in the business community. I guess he didn't really get in on the ground floor of Sioux Falls. He's one of those sort of entrepreneur and businessman who came after the turn of the century. You know, probably 30 yeah. years after Pettigrew and some of that group. But he really helped spur Sioux Falls into the 20th century. I mean, eventually his baking company had like 130 different products. So they were making biscuits. We'd call them crackers today. They made cookies. They had different bread types that they made and sold. And the business actually expanded way beyond the bounds of Sioux Falls. He had a plant in Rapid City and in Aberdeen and one in Fargo and in Des Moines and Sioux City. So it really spread out at one time. I'm not sure what really led to its demise, but in 1961, Raven Industries, which was just starting out, bought that building and has used it ever since.
Yeah. I'm looking, and folks can find the story and images at sdpb.org for the Manchester Biscuit Company for today's Images of the Past. And Bill, I'm looking at some of these people who work there. There are a lot of women in these photos and some kind of interesting, I guess, uniforms. So tell me, what do we know about his workforce? Would that have been unusual in the 1900s to have that many women on staff? I guess this picture is from 1935, though, so that makes a difference, I bet.
There are a number of images, and it seems as though a fair size portion of his workforce were women and had experience in baking. The little I know about the organization, it seems to have been a very conscientious of his workers and really took mm-hmm. care of them. We've got a large plaque in the museum collection that's from 1945 that lists all the members of the Manchester Biscuit Company who served in the different armed forces during World War II. So he seems to have been very proud of the company's interaction in the community.
Yeah. Tell me where he is buried.
Well, he's buried in Woodlawn Cemetery here in Sioux Falls, over on 26th Street. Has a nice granite stone.
So much history in that cemetery. It's astonishing.
Thousands of great stories just waiting to be discovered.
And the museum, really has does so much. Much of the museum's mission is really outreach and education, and walking tours of that museum are part of that. So many people are sort of waiting and excited for those things to be in place again. But they will be, right? They will be someday.
Yep. I think we are still tentatively planning some of our historic walking tours outdoors where people can space out. That will be happening later this summer. We haven't set the exact schedule yet, sort of waiting to see how things play out, but we have a number of those planned for the summer.
Yeah. South Dakota State Archives is collecting images and stories of the pandemic for people to sort of bring in. As someone who goes through a lot of historical artifacts and works with curators and figuring out how to interpret that, what's your advice in the last minute or so we have, Bill, of what do you think people should save right now? What do you think has value that someday, 100 years from now, someone will look back and say, oh, that's interesting?
Well, I think it would be great if people, with their staying at home, they're doing this different thing during the pandemic, if you kept the daily journal, jot down some of the things that you do, you see, you think, what's going on in daily life. I think today, so much of our life is digital. It's going to be hard for museums 50 years from now to really describe what life was like during the pandemic, because a lot of our traditional sources aren't going to be there. But if you keep a journal, maybe some photos or some other things that come your way, the mask that you've made for the pandemic, those are things that you can keep and pass on to the future.
Jokes chalked on sidewalks, teddy bears in windows, nightly noise, and front porch concerts. Sioux Falls' neighbors are doing their part to maintain community in a time of social distancing, and SDPB's Laura Rohde has this snapshot.
Katrina Lear McKinney lives in the All Saints neighborhood near downtown Sioux Falls.
We are all the same. We're all humans. We're all struggling.
Katrina Lear McKinney also serves as president of the All Saints Neighborhood Association. She helped organize a front porch concert stroll. It was held nearly 7 weeks after the mayor of Sioux Falls asked citizens to do their part to flatten the curve by maintaining social distancing.
I think that that human-to-human connection really shines through music and art. So whenever we can lift up our humanity through the arts, it will just help all of us out.
Even though it was raining when the music stroll began, neighbors showed up for the event. Musician Jim Brzezinski says the music helped everyone take their minds off the virus.
And, you know, it's moving to kind of have that, to see people who, you know, people want to get out. They want to be able to have that kind of feeling and the music brings you.
Home to nearly 800 residents in Lyon Park, All Saints Neighborhood is one of Sioux Falls' 7 historic districts, and it's one of 20 organized neighborhood associations within the city. Diane DeCoyer is the neighborhood and historic preservation planner for the city of Sioux Falls. She says the associations are volunteer-run groups organized to promote safety and community.
It's really to help bring people together, and it gives them more of a sense of community and really a sense of safety, because I think when you know your neighbors and you're all looking out for each other, people do feel safer.
In her role, DeCoyer helps neighborhood associations get established and serves as a liaison between the neighborhoods and the city. Year-round, many neighborhood associations like All Saints maintain communication with neighbors through meetings, neighborhood Facebook pages, or like the Cathedral Historic District, an electronic newsletter. For nearly 15 years, Gail Kane and her husband Sam have sent out a monthly newsletter to keep residents of Sioux Falls' oldest neighborhood connected to each other and neighborhood happenings.
Community is a group of people that care about each other and feel they belong together. And that's what I feel about this neighborhood, that we're all, and it's sort of like we're all in this together, good times and bad.
And although neighbors can't get together for potlucks or monthly book club or woodworkers meetings, Kane still had information to publish. She collected ideas from neighbors for ways to safely stay connected, ideas like putting teddy bears in the window for families to enjoy while walking, and even a nightly noise-making session to show appreciation for essential workers.
And I feel like I'm doing something with someone, with the community, and it helps me feel a part of something with other people.
That was 10-year-old Ophelia Ridout Norris. Feeling connected to her neighbors, a community outside the family she's sheltering at home with, also means a lot to Cathedral neighbor Leah Pitty.
We can't have grandmas and grandpas over. We can't go to their homes and see cousins and aunts for holidays or anything like that. So this becomes kind of our most immediate and most needed connection, is seeing the people that we get to see all year round, but now just their voices and their faces, even if it's from afar, mean a lot more because we can't see so many of the other people that we love.
And staying connected is more important today, according to All Saints neighbor and musician Rick Weiland.
So there's all that uncertainty about it, you know, our health, our economy, and just to take a little break, you know, on a Saturday afternoon from 4 to 5 and sing some songs, and to have people, you know, enjoy it as much as we did, singing them and playing them, it was pretty impressive.
Weiland played guitar on his front porch, accompanying his daughter, Alexandra Newcomb Weiland. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.
And now it's time for poetry from Studio 47.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Sandy Longhorn. Longhorn was born on January 7th, 1971, in Waterloo, Iowa. She got interested in writing at a very early age. When asked about her passion for the written word, she had this to say in a recent interview. "I was interested in writing from the time I could hold a pencil. This stemmed directly from being an avid reader. I get such a charge out of reading anything that moves me, that teaches me what it means to be alive in this weird, joyful, terrifying world, that once I started writing, I wanted to share that feeling with readers too. I always loved the sounds of words and how they built meaning." After graduating from Waterloo West High School, Longhorn went to the College of St. Benedict in St. Joseph, Minnesota, where she majored in English and graduated summa cum laude. Shortly after receiving her bachelor's degree, she moved around the country and worked for a variety of independent publishers. In time, she went to the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, where she took an MFA in poetry. Her books include Blood Almanac, The Girlhood Book of Prairie Myths, and The Alchemy of My Mortal Soul. Longhorn has won the Jacquard Press Full-Length Book Award, the Anhinga Prize, the Louise Boggan Award, and she has won fellowships from the Porter Fund Literary Prize, as well as the Arkansas Arts Council. She teaches creative writing at the University of Central Arkansas, where she directs the CD Write Women Writers Conference. Today's poem is Jack and Diane, Rearview Mirror. Art, of course, does not exist in a vacuum. Artists of all stripes, be they painters, musicians, potters, or writers, are influenced by the world around them. I particularly like poems that directly reference their point of inspiration, their genesis, if you will. In poetry, you'll often see a small tagline beneath a title that says something like, "After Emily Dickinson," or "After Edna St. Vincent Millay." This is the poet's way of telling the reader they are using a previous poem. It is a way to carry on a conversation. It is a way to help readers know how a poem should be framed and considered. Poets have been doing this for centuries, and it is, of course, a way of paying homage. What I really like about our poem for today is how Longhorn takes a familiar song, in this case, John Mellencamp's Jack and Diane, and she wonders what happens to that couple in the future. If Mellencamp is interested in two teenage American kids, Longhorn wonders what happens after they graduate from high school and the realities of adulthood come crashing down upon them. This is Jack and Diane, Rearview Mirror by Sandy Longhorn. Diane's mother drove her to Des Moines to have the baby, planned a C-section so Catholic Charities could be on hand to receive the newborn and pass it on to a better home. Jack, he left the state, made the second string at a D2 school before he got cut for a DUI on homecoming. The last she heard, he drifted down to Davenport, where he worked a lock and dam. Diane dreamed at night about her baby's face, a slick blur she caught from the corner of her eye in the delivery room, worked to get a certificate from the local junior college, and took a job managing the office for Ray's Plumbing and Heating. Holding on to 16, she feathered her hair and kept her Bobby Brooks a bit too tight when she went to the locker room tavern. Pregnant again, at 19, she moved from home, married the shortstop for the Smokin' Aces softball team, and had his number tattooed over her heart. She gave up cigs for good when Brad Jr. was born, saved back a stash of cash to buy him authentic polo shirts and hush puppy baby shoes. Diane made damn sure he had a football in his hands the day he learned to stand.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded remotely due to the coronavirus pandemic and produced by Peter Folliard. We both send our best wishes. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.